whom I dated for 2 months. Longevity has never been my strong suit. Cheney was adorable, but cute isn't sufficient to sustain a relationship. I'm difficult. I know this. I was raised by a maiden aunt who thought to foster my independence by giving me a dollar every Saturday and Sunday morning and turning me out on my own. I did learn to ride the bus from one end of town to the other, and I could cheat my way into 2 movies for the price of one. But she wasn't big on companionship, and because of that, being close makes me sweaty and short of breath. I'd noticed that the longer Cheney and I dated, the more I was entertaining fantasies of Robert Dietz, a man I hadn't heard from in 2 years. What that told me was that I preferred to bond with someone who was always out of town. Cheney was a cop. He liked action, a fast pace, and the company of others, where I preferred to be alone. For me, small talk is hard work, and groups of any size wear me down. Cheney was a man who started many projects and finished none. During the time we were together, his floors were perpetually covered with drop cloths, and the air smelled of fresh paint, though I never saw him lift a brush. The hardware had been removed from all the interior doors, which meant you had to stick your finger through a hole and pull when you passed from room to room. Behind his two-car garage, he had a truck up on blocks. It was out of sight, and the neighbors had no complaints. But the same crescent wrench had been rained on so often, the rust formed a wrench-shaped pattern on the drive. I like closure. It drives me nuts to see a cabinet door left ajar. I like to plan. I prepare in advance and leave nothing to chance, while Cheney fancies himself a free spirit, taking life on the wing. At the same time, I buy on impulse, and Cheney spends weeks doing market research. He likes thinking aloud, whereas I get bored with debates about matters in which I have no vested interest. It wasn't that his way was any better or worse than mine. We were simply different in areas we couldn't negotiate. I finally leveled with him in a conversation so painful that it doesn't bear repeating. I still don't believe he was as wounded as he led me to believe. On some level, he must have been relieved, because he couldn't have enjoyed the friction any more than I did. Now that we'd split, what I loved was the sudden quiet in my head, the sense of autonomy, the freedom from social obligations. Best was the pleasure of turning over in bed without bumping into someone else. At 7:15, I roused myself from the sofa and tossed out the napkin I was using as a dinner plate. I rounded up my shoulder bag and jacket, locked my door, and walked the half block to Rosie's. Her tavern is a homely mix of restaurant, pub, and neighborhood watering hole. I say homely because the rambling space is largely unadorned. The bar looks like every other bar you ever saw in your life, a brass foot rail along the front and liquor bottles against mirrored shelves behind. On the wall above the bar, there's a big stuffed marlin with a jockstrap hanging from its spike. This unsavory garment was tossed there by a sports rowdy in a game of chance that Rosie has since discouraged. Crude booths line 2 walls, their plywood sections hammered together and stained a dark, sticky hue. The remaining tables and chairs are of garage sale quality, mismatched formica and chrome with the occasional short leg. Happily, the lighting is bad, so many of the flaws don't show. The air smells of beer, sautéed onions, and certain unidentified Hungarian spices. Absent now is the cigarette smoke which Rosie'd banished the year before. As this was still early in the week, the drinking population was sparse. Above the bar, the television set was tuned to Wheel of Fortune with the sound on mute. Instead of sitting in my usual booth at the back, I perched on a bar stool and waited for Rosie to emerge from the kitchen. Her husband, William, poured me a glass of Chardonnay and set it down in front of me. Like his brother, Henry, he's tall, but much more formal in his attire, favoring highly polished lace-up shoes while Henry prefers flip-flops. William had removed his suit jacket, and he'd made cuffs out of paper toweling, secured with rubber bands, to save the snow-white sleeves of his dress shirt. I said, "Hey, William, how you doing? We haven't chatted in ages." "A bit of chest congestion, but I'm hoping to avoid a full-blown upper respiratory infection," he said. He took a packet from his pants pocket and popped a tablet in his mouth, saying, "Zinc lozenges." "Good deal." William was a bellwether of minor illnesses, which he took very seriously, lest they carry him off. He wasn't as bad as he'd once been, but he kept a keen eye out for anyone's imminent demise. "I hear Gus is in a bad way," he remarked. "Bruised and battered, but aside from that, he's fine." "Don't be too sure," he said. "A fall like that can lead to complications. A fellow might seem fine, but once he's laid up in bed, pneumonia sets in. Blood clots another risk, not to mention a staph infection, which can take you out just like that." A snap of William's fingers put an end to any misplaced optimism on my part. Gus was as good as buried as far as William was concerned. William stood at the ready when it came to death. In large part, Rosie had cured him of his hypochondria, in that her culinary zeal generated sufficient indigestion to keep his imaginary ills at bay. He still leaned toward depression and found there was nothing quite like a funeral to provide a temporary emotional boost. Who could fault the man? At his age, he'd be hard-hearted indeed not to experience a little lift at the sight of a newly departed friend. I said, "I'm more worried about what happens when Gus gets home. He'll be out of commission for a couple of weeks, if not longer." "Right." We were hoping Rosie knew of a family member who'd agree to look after him. "I wouldn't count on relatives. The man is 89 years old. The same age as you, and you've got 4 living siblings, 3 of them in their 90s. But we're from hardier stock. Gus Vronsky smoked most of his life. Still does, for all we know. Your best bet is a home health care service like the Visiting Nurses Association." "You think he has health insurance?" "I doubt it. He probably didn't imagine he'd live long enough to enjoy it. But he'll be covered by Medicaid or Medicare." "I suppose so." Rosie came out of the kitchen through the swinging door, backside first. She had a dinner plate in each hand, one heaped with pan-fried pork steak and stuffed cabbage rolls, and the other with Hungarian beef stew over egg noodles. She delivered the entrees to the day drinkers at the far end of the bar. I was sure they'd been there since noon, and she might well be comping their dinner in hopes of sobering them up before they staggered home. She joined us at the bar, and I filled her in briefly on the nature of our concerns about Gus. "He has a great niece," she said promptly. "She hasn't seen him in years, so she's very fond of him." "Really? That's great. Does she live here in town?" "New York." "That won't do him any good. The doctor won't release him unless he has someone to look after him." Rosie waved the notion aside. "Put in nursing home is what I did with my sister." William leaned forward. "Who died soon afterward." Rosie ignored him. "It's a nice place where a chapel crosses missile." "What about his niece? Do you have any idea how I might get in touch with her?"
"He has her name in a book he keeps in his desk."
"Well, that's a start," I said. When the alarm went off Tuesday morning at 6 o'clock, I dragged my sorry butt out of bed and pulled on my sockinies. I'd slept in my sweats, which saved me one step in my newly inaugurated morning ritual. While I was brushing my teeth, I stared at myself in the mirror with despair. During the night, my errant hair had formed a cone on top that I had to dampen with water and flatten with my palm. I locked my front door and tied my house key into the lace of one running shoe. As I pushed through the gate, I paused and made a big show of stretching my hamstrings in case anybody cared. Then I headed over to Cabana Boulevard, where I trotted along the bike path for a block with the beach to my right. In the weeks since I had last jogged, the sun was slower to rise, which made the early morning hour seem even darker. The ocean looked sullen and black, and the waves sounded cold as they pounded on the sand. Some miles out, the Channel Islands were laid against the horizon in a dark, ragged line. Ordinarily, I'd have given little thought to my route, but when I reached the intersection of Cabana and State Street, I glanced to my left and realized there was something reassuring about the bright band of lights strung out on each side. There was no one else out at that hour, and the storefronts were dark, but I followed my instincts and left the beach behind, heading toward downtown Santa Teresa, which was 10 blocks north. Lower State plays host to the train station, a bicycle rental lot, and a sea and surf establishment where boards, bikinis, and snorkeling gear are sold. Half a block up, there was a t-shirt shop, and a couple of flea-bag hotels. The more upscale of the two, the Paramount, had been the lodging of choice in the 40s when the Hollywood darlings journeyed to Santa Teresa by train. It was a short walk from the station to the hotel, which boasted a pool fed by natural hot springs. The pool had been shut down after workers discovered that seepage from an abandoned service station was leaking toxic chemicals into the aquifer. The hotel had changed hands, and the new owner was rehabilitating the once grand facility. The interior work had been completed, and a new pool was now under construction. The public was invited to peek through holes in the temporary barrier erected to protect the site. I'd stopped to look myself one morning, but all I could see were piles of rubbish and sections of the old mosaic tile. I continued running for 10 blocks and then turned around, tuning into my surroundings as a way of taking my mind off my heaving lungs. The chilly pre-dawn air felt good. The sky had turned from charcoal to ashen gray. Nearing the end of my run, I could hear the early morning freight train rumble slowly through town with a muted blast from its horn. Dinging merrily, the signal gates came down. I waited while it passed. I counted 6 boxcars, a tank car, an empty livestock car, refrigerator car, 9 container cars, 3 hardtop gondolas, a flat car, and finally, the caboose. When the train was out of sight, I continued at a walk, using the last few blocks to cool down. Mostly, I was happy to have the run out of the way. I skipped my shower, figuring I might as well stay grungy for the housework to come. I rounded up rubber gloves, sponges, and assorted cleaning products, all of which I tossed in a plastic bucket. I added a roll of paper toweling, rags, laundry soap, and black plastic trash bags. Thus armed, I went out to the patio where I waited for Henry. There's nothing like the danger and the glamour of a privatized life. When Henry appeared, we went over to Gus's place. Henry did a walkabout to assess the situation, and then returned to the living room and gathered up the many weeks' worth of newspapers scattered on the floor. For my part, I stood assessing the furnishings. The drapes were skimpy, and the 4 upholstered pieces, 1 couch and 3 easy chairs, were encased in dark brown stretchy slipcovers of the one-size-fits-all variety. The tables were made of chipped laminate veneer, meant to look like mahogany. Just being in the room was discouraging. My first self-assigned task was to search Gus's roll-top desk for his address book, which was tucked in the pencil drawer along with a house key with a round white tag marked Pitts. I held it up. "What's this? I didn't know Gus had a key to your place." "Sure. That's why I have a key to his. Believe it or not, there was a time when he wasn't such a grouch. He used to bring in the mail and water my plants when I went off to Michigan to visit the Sibs." "Well, wonders never cease," I said, and returned to the task at hand, while Henry carried the stack of papers to the kitchen and stuffed them in the trash. Gus's financial dealings were well organized, paid bills in 1 pigeonhole, the unpaid in another. In a third, I found his checkbook, 2 savings account books, and his bank statements bound by rubber bands. I couldn't help but notice the amount of cash he had in his accounts. Well, okay, I studied the numbers carefully, but I didn't take notes. There was close to $2,000 in his checking account, $15,000 in 1 savings account, and $22,000 in another. This might not be the whole of it. He struck me as the sort of fellow who stuck $100 bills between the pages of his books and kept untouched accounts in a number of different banks. The regular deposits he made were probably Social Security or pension checks. "Hey, Henry, what did Gus do for a living before he retired?" Henry stuck his head around the corner from the hallway. "He worked for the railroad back east. Might have been the L&N, but I'm not sure in what capacity. What makes you ask?" "He's got a fair amount of money. I mean, the guy's not rich, but he has the means to live a lot better than this." "I don't think money and cleanliness are connected. Did you find his address book?" "Right here. The only person living in New York is a Melanie Oberlin, who has to be his niece." "Why don't you go ahead and call?" "You think?" "Why not? You might as well put it on his phone bill. Meanwhile, I'll start on the kitchen. You can take his bedroom and his bath as soon as you're done." I placed the call, but as is usually the case these days, I didn't talk to a live human being. The woman on the answering machine identified herself as Melanie, no last name, but she wasn't able to take my call. She sounded pretty cheerful for someone who told me, at the same time, just how sorry she was. I gave a brief account of her Uncle Gus's fall and then left my name, my home, and office numbers, and asked her to return the call. I tucked the address book in my pocket, thinking I'd try again later if I didn't hear from her. I toured Gus's house as Henry had. In the hall, I could smell the fug of mouse droppings and perhaps a mouse corpse of recent vintage trapped in a wall nearby. The second bedroom was filled with an accumulation of unlabeled cardboard boxes and old furniture, some of it quite good. The third bedroom was devoted to items the old man evidently couldn't bring himself to toss. Bundles of twine-bound newspapers had been stacked head-high, with aisles laid out between the rows for easy access in case someone needed to get in and collect all the Sunday funnies from December of 1964. There were empty vodka bottles, cases of canned goods, and bottled water sufficient to withstand a siege. Bicycle frames, two rusted lawnmowers, a carton of women's shoes, and three stingy-looking TV sets with rabbit-ear antennas and screens the size of airplane windows. He'd filled an old wooden crate with tools. An old daybed was buried under jumbled mounds of clothing. An entire set of green glass Depression-era dinnerware was stacked on a coffee table. I counted 15 ornate picture frames laid up against one wall. I flipped the frames forward and peered at the paintings from above, but I didn't know what to make of them. The subject matter was varied: landscapes, portraits, one painting of a lush but drooping bouquet, another of a tabletop adorned with cut fruit, a silver pitcher, and a dead duck with its head hanging off the edge. The oil, on most, had darkened so much it was like looking through a tinted window. I know nothing about art, so I had no opinion about his collection, except for the dead duck, which I thought was in questionable taste. I got busy in the bathroom, thinking to get the worst of it out of the way. I disconnected my emotional gears, much as I do at the scene of a homicide. Revulsion is useless when you have a job to do. For the next 2 hours, we scrubbed and scoured, dusted and vacuumed. Henry emptied the refrigerator and filled two large trash bags with unidentified rotting foodstuffs. The cupboard shelves held canned goods that bulged along the bottoms, signaling imminent explosion. He ran a load of dishes while I tossed a mound of dirty clothes in the washer and ran that as well. The bedding I left in a heap on the laundry room floor until the washer was free. By noon, we'd covered as much ground as we could. Now that a modicum of order had been restored, I could see how depressing the house was. We could have worked another 2 full days, and the result would have been the same. Dinginess, neglect, a pall of old dreams hovering midair. We closed up the house, and Henry rolled 2 big garbage cans out to the curb in front. He said he'd get cleaned up and then hit the supermarket to restock Gus's shelves. After that, he'd call the hospital and find out when he was being released. I went home, took a shower, and got dressed for work in my usual jeans. I decided to make a second try at delivering the order to show cause to my pal Bob Vest. This time, when I parked and crossed the street to knock on his door, I noticed 2 newspapers lying on the porch. This was not a good sign. I waited, on the off chance that I'd caught him on the john with his knickers down around his knees. While I stood there, I spotted a scratching post on one side of the porch. The carpeted surface was untouched, as the cat apparently preferred to sharpen its claws by shredding the welcome mat. A sooty-looking cat bed was matted with hair, dander, and flea eggs, with no visible cat. I went out to the mailbox and checked the contents. Junk mail, catalogs, a few bills, and a handful of magazines. I tucked the pile under my arm and crossed the lawn to his neighbor's house. I rang the bell. The door was answered by a woman in her 60s, cigarette in hand. The air around her smelled of fried bacon and maple syrup. She wore a tank top and pedal pushers. Her arms were scrawny and her pants rested loosely on her hips. I said, "Hi, do you know when Bob's getting back? He asked me to bring in his mail. I thought he was getting home last night, but I see his newspapers haven't been taken in." She opened the screen door and peered past me at his drive. "How'd he manage to rope you in? He asked me to mind his cat, but he never said a word about the mail." "Maybe he didn't want to bother you with that." "I don't know why not. He's happy to bother me about everything else." That cat thinks he lives here, as often as I look after him. Scruffy old thing, I feel sorry for him. I wasn't crazy about Bob's neglect of the cat. Shame on him. Did he mention when he'd be home? He said this afternoon, if you put any stock in that. Sometimes he claims he'll be gone for 2 days when he knows it'll be a week. He thinks I'm more likely to agree to shorter absences. Oh, you know Bob, I said, and then held up the mail. Anyway, I'll just leave this on his doorstep. I can take it if you like. Thanks. That's nice of you. She studied me. None of my business, but you're not the new gal he keeps talking about. Absolutely not. I've got problems enough without taking him on. Good. I'm glad. You don't look like his type. What type is that? The type I see leaving his house most mornings at 6 a.m. When I got to the office, I put a call through to Henry, who brought me up to date. As it turned out, the doctor had decided to keep Gus an extra day because his blood pressure was high and his red blood cell count was low. Since Gus was spaced out on pain medication, Henry was the one who dealt with a discharge planner in the hospital's social services department, trying to find a way to accommodate Gus's medical needs once he got the boot. Henry offered to explain to me the intricacies of Medicare coverage, but it was really too boring to take in. Beyond Part A and Part B, everything seemed to have three initials: CMN, SNF, PPS, PROs, DRGs. On and on it went in that vein. Since I wouldn't have to navigate those rapids for another 30 years, the information was simply tedious. The guidelines were diabolically cunning, designed to confuse the very patients they were meant to educate. There was apparently a formula that determined how much money the hospital could make by keeping him for a specified number of days, and how much the same hospital could lose by keeping him 1 day longer. Gus's dislocated shoulder, while painful, swollen, and temporarily debilitating, wasn't considered serious enough to warrant more than a two-night stay. He was nowhere close to using up the days allotted him, but the hospital was taking no chances. On Wednesday, Gus was discharged from St. Terry's to a skilled nursing facility, otherwise known as an SNF. Chapter 7. Rolling Hill Senior Retreat was a rambling one-story brick structure on a tenth of an acre without a hill of any sort, rolling or otherwise. Some attempt had been made to tart up the exterior by adding an ornamental birdbath and two iron benches of the sort that leave marks on the seat of your pants. The parking lot was a stern black and smelled as though the asphalt had just been redone. In the narrow front yard, ivy formed a dense carpet of green that had swarmed up the sides of the building, across the windows, and over the edge of the roof. In a year, the place would be covered by a jungle of green, a low, amorphous mound like a lost Mayan pyramid. Inside, the lobby was painted in bright primary colors. Maybe the elderly, like babies, were thought to benefit from the stimulation of strong hues. In the far corner, someone had taken a fake Christmas tree from its box and had gone so far as to stick the aluminum branches in the requisite holes. The conformation of branches looked about as realistic as recently transplanted hair plugs. So far, there were no ornaments and no tree lights. With so little late afternoon sunlight penetrating the window panes, the overall effect was cheerless. Linked chairs of chrome with bright yellow plastic seats lined the room on two sides. Of necessity, lamps were turned on, but bulbs were the same paltry wattage used in cheap motels. The receptionist was concealed behind an opaque sliding window of the sort that greets you in a doctor's office. An upright cardboard rack held brochures that made Rolling Hill Senior Retreat look like a Golden Years resort. In a montage of photographs, handsome, energetic-looking oldsters sat on a garden patio engaged in happy group chat while playing a game of cards. Another image showed the cafeteria where two ambulatory couples enjoyed a gourmet repast. In reality, the place had stimulated my hopes for an early and sudden death. On the way over, I'd stopped at a market where I'd stood for some time staring at the magazine rack. What kind of reading would amuse a cranky old man? I bought Model Railroading magazine, a Playboy, and a book of crossword puzzles. Also, a giant-sized candy bar, in case he had a sweet tooth and hankered for one. I hadn't been in the lobby long, but since no one had opened the receptionist's window, I tapped on the partition. The window slid back 3 inches, and a woman in her 50s peered out. "Oh, sorry. I didn't realize anyone was out there. Can I help you?" "I'd like to see a patient, Gus Vronsky. He was admitted earlier today." She consulted her Rolodex and then made a phone call, keeping her palm close to the mouthpiece so I couldn't read her lips. After she hung up, she said, "Have a seat. Someone will be out shortly." I sat down in a chair that allowed me a view of a corridor with administrative offices opening off each side. At the end, where a second corridor crossed the first, a nurse's station diverted foot traffic like water flowing around a rock in the middle of a stream. I was guessing hospital rooms were located down the two peripheral halls. Living quarters for the active, healthy residents must be somewhere else. I knew the cafeteria was close because the smell of food was strong. I closed my eyes and sorted the meal into its component parts. Meat, perhaps pork, carrots, turnips, and something else. Probably yesterday's salmon. I pictured a row of heat lamps beaming down on 10x13 stainless steel food pans. One filled to the brim with chicken parts and milk gravy, another filled with glazed sweet potatoes, a third with mashed potatoes, stiff and slightly dried around the edges. By comparison, how bad could it be to eat a quarter pounder with cheese? Facing this muck at the end of life, why deny myself now? In due course, a middle-aged volunteer in a pink cotton smock came and fetched me from the reception area. As she led me down the hallway, she didn't say a word, but she did so in a very pleasant manner. Gus was in a semi-private room, sitting upright in the bed closest to the window. The only view was of the underside of ivy vines, dense rows of white roots that looked like the legs of millipedes. His arm was in a sling, and the bruises from his fall appeared from the various gaping holes in his gown. His Medicare coverage didn't provide private duty nursing, a phone, or a television set. His roommate's bed was surrounded by a curtain on a track, pulled in a half circle that delivered him from sight. In the quiet, I could hear him breathing heavily, a cross between a rasp and a sigh that had me counting his inhalations in case he stopped and it was up to me to perform CPR. I tiptoed to Gus's bedside and found myself using my public library voice. "Hello, Mr. Vronsky. I'm Kinsey Milhone, your next-door neighbor."
"I know who you are. I didn't fall on my head." Gus spoke in his normal tone, which came across as a shout. I glanced uneasily toward his roommate's bed, wondering if the poor guy would be jarred out of his sleep. I placed the items I'd bought on the rolling table beside Gus's bed, hoping to appease his ill temper. "I brought you a candy bar and some magazines. How are you doing?"
"What's it look like? I hurt."
"I can just imagine," I murmured.
"Quit that whispering and talk like a normal human being. If you don't raise your voice, I can't hear a word."
"Sorry."
"Sorry doesn't help. Before you ask another stupid question, I'm sitting up like this because if I lie on my back, the pain is worse. Right now, the throbbing's excruciating, and it makes my whole body feel like hell. Look at this bruise from all the blood they've drawn. Must have been a quart and a half and four big tubes. The lab report says I'm anemic, but I didn't have a problem until they started in."
I kept my expression sympathetic, but I was fresh out of consolation. Gus snorted with disgust.
"One day in this bed and my backside is raw. I'll be covered with sores if I'm here one more day."
"You ought to mention it to your doctor or one of the nurses."
"What doctor? What nurses? No one's been in here for the past 2 hours. Anyway, that doctor's an idiot. He has no idea what he's talking about. What did he say about my release? He better sign it soon or I'm walking out. I may be sick, but I'm not a prisoner, unless getting old is a crime, which is how it's regarded in this country."
"I haven't talked to the floor nurse, but Henry will be here in a bit, and he can ask. I did call your niece in New York to let her know what was going on."
"Melanie? She's useless. Too busy and self-absorbed to worry about the likes of me."
"I didn't actually talk to her. I left a message on her machine, and I'm hoping to hear back."
She's no help. She hasn't come to visit me for years. I told her I'm taking her out of my will. You know why I haven't done it? Because it costs too much. Why should I pay a lawyer hundreds of dollars to make sure she doesn't get a cent? What's the point? I've got life insurance, too, but I hate dealing with my agent because he's always trying to talk me into something new. If I take her name out as beneficiary, I have to figure out who to put in. I don't have anyone else, and I won't leave a thing to charity. Why should I do that? I worked hard for my money. I say let other people do the same. Well, there's that, I said, for lack of anything better. Gus looked at the semicircle of curtain. What's the matter with him? He better quit that gasping. It's getting on my nerves. I think he's asleep. Well, it's damned inconsiderate. If you want, I can hold a pillow over his face, I said. Just kidding, I added when he didn't laugh. I took a peek at my watch. I'd been with him the better part of 4 minutes. Mr. Vronsky, can I get you some ice before I have to take off?
No, just get on with you. To hell with it. You think I complain too much, but you don't know the half of it. You've never been old.
Great. Okay, well, I'll see you later.
I made my escape, unwilling to spend another minute in his company. I had no doubt his testiness was a result of his misery and pain, but I wasn't required to stand in the line of fire. I retrieved my car from the parking lot, feeling as irritable and out of sorts as he. As long as I was in a bad mood anyway, I decided to try serving Bob Vest again. He might get away with neglecting his cat, but he better pay attention to his ex-wife and kids. I drove to his house and parked across the street as I had before. I tried my habitual knock on the door to no great effect. Where the hell was the guy? Given that this was my third attempt, I could technically pack it in and file an affidavit of inability to serve process. But I felt I was getting close. I didn't want to give it up. I returned to my car and ate the brown bag lunch I'd packed, an olive pimento cheese sandwich on whole grain bread, and a cluster of grapes, which made 2 servings of fruit in 2 days. I'd brought a book with me and alternated between reading and listening to the car radio. At intervals, I ran the engine, turned on the heater, and allowed the interior of the Mustang to fill with blessed warmth. This was getting old. If Vest didn't show up by 2, I was taking off. I could always decide later whether it was worth another try. At 1:35, a late-model pickup truck appeared, moving in my direction. The driver turned to look at me as he pulled into the drive and parked. The truck and the license plate matched the vehicle information I'd been given. From the description, this guy was the very Bob I'd been hired to serve. Before I could make a move, he got out, retrieved a duffel from the truck bed, and toted it up the walk. A scruffy gray cat appeared out of nowhere and trotted after him. He unlocked the front door in haste, and the cat was quick to skitter in while he had the chance. Bob glanced in my direction again before he closed the door behind him. This was not good. If he suspected he was being served, he might get cute and scurry out the back door to avoid me. If I could demonstrate a reason for my presence, I might dampen his paranoia and lure him into my trap. I got out, moved to the front of the car, and lifted the hood. I made a serious display of tinkering with the engine, then put my hands on my hips and shook my head. Gosh! A girl is sure baffled by a big old dirty engine like this. I waited a decent interval and then lowered the hood with a bang. I crossed the street and moved up his walk to the front porch. I knocked on his door. Nothing. I knocked again. Hello? Sorry to bother you, but I wondered if I could use your phone. I think my battery's dead. I could have sworn he was on the other side of the door, listening to me as I tried listening to him. No response. I knocked one more time, and after a minute, I went back to my car. I sat and stared at the house. To my surprise, Vest opened the front door and peered out at me. I reached over and busied myself in the glove compartment, as though searching for the service manual. Would a 17-year-old Mustang even have a service manual? When I looked back again, he had come down the porch steps and was heading in my direction. Oh, shit. 40s, gray at the temples, blue eyes. His face was marked by a series of tight lines, a grimace of perpetual discontent. He didn't seem to be armed, which I found encouraging. Once he was in range, I lowered the window and said, "Hi, how are you?"
"Was that you knocking on my door?"
"Uh-huh. I was hoping to use the phone."
"What's the problem?"
"I can't get the engine to turn over."
"Want me to give it a try?"
"Sure." I saw his gaze shift to the summons on the front seat beside me, but must not have registered the reference to Superior Court and all the talk of plaintiff versus the defendant, because he didn't gasp or recoil in dismay. I folded the document and shoved it in my shoulder bag as I emerged from the car. He took my place in the driver's seat, but instead of turning the key, he put his hands on the steering wheel and shook his head with admiration.
"I used to own one of these babies. Jesus, the Boss 429, king of all muscle cars. And I sold mine. Sold, hell. I as good as gave it away. I'm still kicking myself. I didn't even remember what I needed the money for. Probably something dumb. Where'd you find it?"
"In a used car lot on Lower Chapel. I bought it on a whim. The dealer hadn't had it half a day. He told me there weren't many made."
"499 total in 1970, he said. Ford developed the 429 engine in 1968 after Petty started eating up NASCAR wins with his 426 Hemi Belvedere. Remember Bunky Knudsen?"
Not really.
"Yeah, well, right around that same time he left GM and took over as the new boss at Ford. He's the one talked him into using the 429 engine in the Mustang and Cougar lines. Sucker's so big the suspension had to be relocated. They had to stick the battery in the trunk. Turned out to be money losers. But the Boss 302 and the 429 are still the hottest cars ever made. What'd you pay for it?"
$5,000. I thought he'd bang his head on the steering wheel, but he shook it instead. One of those slow wags denoting copious regret.
"I never should have asked."
With that, he turned the key in the ignition, and the engine fired right up.
"You must have flooded the engine."
Silly me. I appreciate the help."
"No biggie," he said. "You ever want to sell a car, you know where I am."
He got out and stood aside to let me into the car. I pulled the papers from my bag. "You're not Bob Vest by any chance?"
"I am. Have we met?"
I held out the summons, which he took automatically when I tapped him on the arm. "Nope. Sorry to have to say this, but you're served," I said, as I slid under the steering wheel.
"I'm what?"
He looked down at the papers, and when he saw what he had, he said,
"Well, shit.
And by the way, you ought to take better care of your cat." When I got back to the office, I put in a second call to Gus's niece. With the 3-hour time difference, I was hoping she'd come home from work. The phone rang so long that I was startled when she finally picked up. I repeated my original report in an abbreviated form. She seemed to draw a blank, like she didn't have any idea what I was talking about. I went through my spiel again in a more elaborate rendition, telling her who I was, what had happened to Gus, his move to the nursing home, and the need for someone, namely her, to come to his aid. She said, "You're kidding." "That's not quite the response I was hoping for," I said. "I'm 3,000 miles away. You think it's really that big of an emergency?" "Well, he's not bleeding out or anything like that, but he does need your help. Someone has to get the situation under control. He's in no position to take care of himself." Her silence suggested she wasn't receptive to the idea, in whole or in part. What was wrong with this chick? "What sort of work do you do?" I asked as a prompt. "I'm an executive VP in an ad agency." "Do you think you could talk to your boss?"
"And say what?"
"Tell him it's a her."
"Great. I'm sure she'll understand the kind of crisis we've got on our hands. Gus is 89 years old, and you're his only living relative."
Her tone shifted from resistance to mere reluctance. "I do have business contacts in L.A. I don't know how quickly I could set it up, but I suppose I could fly out at the end of the week and maybe see him Saturday or Sunday. How would that be?"
"One day in town won't do him any good unless you mean to leave him where he is."
"In the nursing home? That's not such a bad idea."
Yes, it is. He's miserable.
Why? What's wrong with it?
Let's put it this way. I don't know you at all, but I'm reasonably certain you wouldn't be caught dead in a place like that. It's clean, and the care is excellent, but your uncle wants to be in his own home.
Well, that won't work. You said he's not able to care for himself with his shoulder like it is.
That's my point. You'll have to hire someone to look after him.
You couldn't do that? You'd have a better idea how to go about it. I'm out of state.
Melanie, it's your job, not mine. I barely know the man.
Maybe you could pitch in for a couple of days until I find someone else.
Me?
I held the phone away from me and stared at the mouthpiece. Surely she didn't think she could drag me into it. I'm the least nursey person I know, and I have people who'd back me up on the claim. On the rare occasions when I've been pressed into service, I've bumbled my way through, but I never liked it much. My Aunt Jin took a dim view of pain and suffering, which she felt were trumped up purely to get attention. She couldn't tolerate medical complaints, and she thought all so-called serious illnesses were bogus, right up to the moment she was diagnosed with the very cancer she died of. I'm not quite as cold-hearted, but I'm not far behind. I had a sudden vision of hypodermic syringes, and I thought I was on the verge of blacking out, when I realized Melanie was still wheedling. What about the neighbor who found him and called 911?
That was me.
Oh, I thought there was an old guy who lived next door.
You're talking about Henry Pitts. He's my landlord.
That's right. I remember now. He's retired. My uncle's mentioned him before. Wouldn't he have time to look in on Gus?
I don't think you get it. He doesn't need someone looking in on him. I'm talking about professional nursing care.
Why don't you contact social services? There has to be an agency to handle things like this.
You're his niece.
His great niece. Maybe even great great, she said.
Uh-huh.
I let a silence fall into which she did not leap with joy, offering to fly out. She said,
Hello?
I haven't gone anywhere. I'm just waiting to hear what you're going to do.
Fine.
I'll be out, but I don't appreciate your attitude. She hung up resoundingly to illustrate her point.
Chapter 8. After dinner Friday night, I went with Henry to a Christmas tree lot on Milagro to help him choose a tree, a decision he takes very seriously. Christmas was still 2 weeks away, but Henry's like a little kid when it comes to the holidays. The lot itself was small, but he felt the trees were fresher and the selection better than at other lots he'd tried. In the 6-foot height he preferred, he had several choices: a balsam fir, a Fraser fir, a blue spruce, a Nordman, the Norway, or the noble spruce. He and the man who owned the lot got into a long discussion about the merits of each. The blue spruce, the noble, and the Norway had poor needle retention, and the Nordmans had spindly tips. He finally settled on a dark green balsam fir with a classic shape, soft needles, and the fragrance of a pine forest, or pine saw, depending on your frame of reference. The tree branches were secured with heavy twine, and we hauled it to his station wagon where we tied it across the top with an elaborate configuration of rope and bungee cords. We drove home along Cabana Boulevard, the darkened ocean to our left. Offshore, the oil rigs twinkled like a regatta with the capacity for spills. It was close to 8 by then, and the restaurants and motels across from the beach were ablaze with lights. The glimpse we caught of State Street in passing showed a steady march of seasonal decorations as far as the eye could see. Henry parked in his driveway, and we eased the tree out of its restraints. With him toting the trunk end and me struggling along at the midpoint, we wrestled the evergreen around to the street, up his short walk, and in the front door. Henry had rearranged the furniture to clear a place for the tree in one corner of the living room. Once we'd stabilized it in its stand, he tightened the T-bolts and added water to the reservoir below. He'd already pulled 6 boxes marked Xmas from his attic and stacked them nearby. 5 were filled with carefully wrapped ornaments, and the 6th box contained a formidable tangle of Christmas tree lights. When are you doing the lights and ornaments?
Tomorrow afternoon.
Charlotte has an open house from 2 until 5, and she'll stop by when she's done. You're welcome to join us. I'm making eggnog to get us in the proper spirit. Oh, I don't want to horn in on your date. Don't be silly. William and Rosie are coming, too. Have they met her? William has, and he gave her a thumbs up. I'm curious about Rosie's reaction. She's a tough one. Why the opinion poll? You either like her or you don't. I don't know. Something about the woman bothers me. As in what? You don't find her a bit single-minded? I've only talked to her once, and I got the impression she was good at what she does. It feels more complicated. She's smart and attractive, I'll give you that. But all she talks about is sell, sell, sell. We took a walk after supper the other night, and she calculated the value of every house on the block. She was ready to go door to door drumming up sales, but I put my foot down. These are my neighbors. Most are retired, and their homes are paid off. So she talks someone into selling, then what? They end up with a pile of cash but no place to live, and no way to buy another home because the market's so high. What was her response? She was good about it and backed off, but I could see the wheels going round and round. She's a go-getter, no doubt about that. In fact, I was worried she'd talk you into selling this place. Henry gestured his dismissal. No danger there. I love my house, and I'd never give it up. She's still lobbying me to get into rental properties, but that doesn't interest me. I have one tenant already, so why do I need more? Okay, so maybe she's ambitious. That doesn't constitute a character flaw. You get hung up in all the fretting, and you'll spoil what you have now. If it doesn't work out, then so be it. Very philosophical, he said. I remember you said that and quoted back to you one day. No doubt. At 9:30, I went back to my place and let myself in. I flipped off the porch light and hung up my jacket. I was ready to settle down with a glass of wine and a good book when I heard a knock at my door. At that hour, chances were good it was someone trying to sell me something or passing out poorly printed pamphlets predicting the end of the world. I was surprised anyone would brave the walk to my door, since the streetlights don't penetrate Henry's backyard and patio. I turned on the outside light and peered through the porthole in my front door. The woman standing on my porch wasn't anyone I knew. She was in her mid-30s with a pale, square face, thinly plucked eyebrows, bright red lipstick, and a thick bunch of auburn hair that she'd caught in a knot on the top of her head. She wore a black business suit, but I didn't see a clipboard or a sample case, so maybe I was safe. When she saw me looking out at her, she smiled and waved. I put the chain on and then opened the door a crack. Yes? Hi, are you Kinsey? I am. My name is Melanie Oberlin, Gus Vronsky's niece. Am I disturbing you? Not at all. Hang on. I closed the door and slid the chain off the track, then let her in. Wow, that was quick. I talked to you 2 days ago. I didn't expect to see you so soon. When did you get in? Just now. I have a rental car out front. Turns out my boss thought the trip was a fabulous idea, so I flew into L.A. last night and met with clients all day. I didn't start the drive up until 7, thinking I'd be clever and avoid the rush hour traffic. But then I got stuck behind a 6-car pileup in Malibu. At any rate, I'm sorry to barge in, but it's just dawned on me I don't have a key to Uncle Gus's place. Is there any way to get in? Henry has a set of keys, and I'm sure he's still up. It won't take me a minute if you want to come in and wait. I'd love to. Thanks. Do you mind if I use the loo? Be my guest. I showed her into the downstairs bathroom, and while she went about her business, I crossed the patio to Henry's back door and tapped on the glass. The kitchen lights were out, but I could see the reflected flicker of the television set in the living room beyond. A moment later, he appeared in the doorway and flipped on the kitchen light before he unlocked the door. I thought you were in for the night, he said. I was, but Gus's niece showed up, and she needs a house key. Hang on. He left the door open while he found the set of keys in his kitchen junk drawer. The way you described your phone conversation, I didn't think she'd come at all, let alone this fast. Me neither. I was pleasantly surprised. How long will she stay? I haven't asked her yet, but I can let you know. You may end up dealing with her anyway, since I have to go to the office first thing tomorrow morning. On Saturday? I'm afraid so. I've got paperwork to catch up on, and I like the quiet. When I returned to the studio, Melanie was still in the bathroom, and the sound of running water suggested she was washing her face. I took two glasses from the cabinet and opened a bottle of Edna Valley Chardonnay. I poured 6 ounces for each of us, and when she came out, I handed her Gus's house key and a glass of wine. I hope you like wine. I took the liberty, I said. Have a seat. Thanks. After 3 hours on the freeway, I could use a drink. I thought Boston drivers were bad, but people out here are lunatics. You're from Boston? More or less. We moved to New York when I was 9, but I went to school in Boston and still visit friends from my BU days. She sat down in one of the director's chairs and did a quick visual survey. Nice. This would be a palace in the city. It's a palace anywhere, I said. I'm glad you made it out here. Henry was just asking how long you might stay. Until the end of next week, if all goes well. In the interest of efficiency, I called the local paper and placed a classified ad that starts tomorrow and runs all next week. They'll put it in the help wanted section. Companion, private duty nurse, that sort of thing. And they'll also run it in the personals. I wasn't sure Uncle Gus had an answering machine, so I gave his address. I hope that wasn't a mistake. I don't see why it would be. You probably won't be swamped with applicants at this time of year. A lot of people postpone job hunting until after the holidays. We'll see how we do. In a pinch, I can always try to scare up a temp. I do apologize for my response when you called. I haven't seen Gus in years, so you caught me off guard. Once I decided to fly out, I thought I might as well do it right. Speaking of Uncle Gus, how is he? I should have asked about him first thing. I didn't get over there to see him today, but Henry did and says he's about as you'd expect. In other words, screaming and shouting. Pretty much. He's been known to throw things, too, when he's really on a tear, or he did way back when. How are you related? I know he's your uncle, but where on the family tree? My mother's side. He was actually her great-uncle, so I guess that makes him a great-great to me. She died 10 years ago this past May, and once his brother passed on, I was the only one left. I feel guilty I haven't seen him for so long. Well, it can't be easy if you're on the East Coast. What about you? You have family out here? Nope. I'm an orphan child as well, which is probably for the best. We chatted for 10 or 15 minutes, and then she glanced at her watch. Oops, I better get going. I don't want to keep you up. In the morning, you can give me directions to the nursing home. I'll be out of here early, but you can always knock on Henry's door. He'll be happy to help. I take it you'll be staying next door. I'd hope to, unless you think he'd object. I'm sure he won't care, but I should warn you, the place is grim. We cleaned what we could, but it's iffy, in my opinion. Who knows when Gus last had a go at it himself? How bad? It's gross. The sheets are clean, but the mattress looks like something he dragged in from the curb. He's a hoarder as well, so 2 of the 3 bedrooms aren't usable at all, unless you're looking for a place to toss trash. He hoards? That's new. He didn't used to do that. He does now. Dishes, clothing, tools, shoes. It looks like he has newspapers from the past 15 years. There were items in the fridge that were probably capable of spreading disease. She wrinkled her nose. You think it's better if I stay somewhere else? I would. I'll take your word for it. How hard is it going to be to find a hotel at this hour? It shouldn't be a problem. We don't get many tourists at this time of year. There are 6 or 8 motels just 2 blocks from here. When I run in the mornings, I always see the vacancy signs lighted. Maybe it was the wine, but I was noticing how friendly I felt, possibly because I was so grateful she'd arrived. Or maybe ours was one of those relationships where you butt heads up front and get along swimmingly from that point on. Whatever the dynamic, the next thing I knew, I was saying, "You can always stay here, for tonight at any rate." She seemed as surprised as I. "Really? That'd be great, but I wouldn't want to put you out." Having offered, of course, I could have bitten off my tongue. But I felt bound by etiquette to assure her of my sincerity, while she swore it'd be no big deal to bumble around in the dark in search of accommodations, clearly something she was hoping to avoid. In the end, I made up a bed for her on the fold-out sofa in my living room. She already knew where the bathroom was, so I took a few minutes to show her how to work the coffee maker and where the cereal box and bowls were stowed. At 11 o'clock, she retreated to her bed, and I climbed the spiral staircase to the loft. Since she was still on East Coast time, she turned her light out long before I did. In the morning, I got up at 8, and by the time I came downstairs, showered, and dressed, she was already up and gone. Like a good guest, she stripped the sheets, which she'd folded neatly and placed on the lid of my washing machine, along with a damp towel she'd used for her shower. She'd refolded the sofa bed and put the cushions back in place. According to the note she'd left, she'd gone in search of a coffee shop and expected to be back by 9. She offered to buy me dinner if I was free that night, which, as it happened, I was. I left for the office at 8:35 that morning, and I didn't see her again for 6 days. So much for dinner. Chapter 9. Late Saturday afternoon, I joined Henry and Charlotte for the tree-trimming festivities. I declined the eggnog, which I knew contained a stunning quantity of calories, not to mention fat and cholesterol. Henry's recipe called for a cup of superfine sugar, a quart of milk, 12 large eggs, and 2 cups of whipping cream. He'd made a non-alcoholic version, which allowed his guests to add bourbon or brandy to taste. By the time I arrived, the Christmas tree lights had been threaded through the branches, and Rosie had already been there and gone. She'd accepted a cup of eggnog, and then she'd left for the restaurant, as her dictatorial presence was required in the kitchen. Henry, William, Charlotte, and I unwrapped and admired the ornaments, most of which had been in Henry's family for years. Once the tree was trimmed, William and Henry had their annual argument about how to apply tinsel. William was of the one-strand-at-a-time method, and Henry thought the effect was more natural if the tinsel was tossed and allowed to form picturesque clumps. They settled on a little bit of both. At 8 o'clock, we walked the half-block to Rosie's. William went to work behind the bar, which left the table to Henry, Charlotte, and me. I hadn't paid attention to how much either had had to drink, which may or may not explain what followed. The menu that night was the usual strange assortment of Hungarian dishes, many of which Rosie had determined in advance would be our free choice for the occasion. While we waited for the first course, I turned to Henry. I saw lights on at Gus's, so I'm assuming you and Melanie connected this morning after I left for work.
We did, and I found her most forceful and effective. She's accustomed to dealing with the hassles of life in New York, so she knows how to get things done. We were at Rolling Hills by 9:15. Of course, there was no sign of the attending physician, and no way to get Gus released without the doctor's official sanction. Somehow, Melanie managed to hunt him down and get his signature on the form. She orchestrated the process with such efficiency, we had Gus out of there and back at his place by 11:10.
She found a place to stay. She checked into the wharf side on Cabana. She also did the grocery shopping and ordered a wheelchair from a rental company. She had it delivered, and she was pushing Gus around the neighborhood this afternoon. The attention worked wonders. He was really quite nice. I was about to make a comment in response when Charlotte spoke up.
Who built the row of houses on your block? They seem very much alike.
Henry turned and looked at her, faintly disconcerted by the change in subject.
Not so. My house and Gus's are mere images of one another, but the house just past the vacant lot and Mosa Lowenstein's place, which is one more door down, have a very different feel. They might have been constructed around the same time, but with the changes people have made in the intervening years, it's hard to tell what the original floor plans were like.
Henry and I exchanged a quick look that Charlotte didn't catch. Sure enough, she steered the conversation around to real estate. I hoped her question was idle, but she was apparently pursuing a train of thought.
I take it none of them were designed by a name architect. Not that I know. Over the years, a series of builders bought up the lots and threw together whatever was easy and cheap.
What makes you ask?
I was thinking about the restrictions on houses over 50 years old. If a house has no historical significance, a buyer would be free to demolish the structure and build something new. Otherwise, you're more or less limited to the footprint, which reduces the potential. Why is that relevant?
None of my neighbors have expressed any interest in selling. She frowned.
I understand there hasn't been much turnover, but given the advanced ages of homeowners in this area, some of these houses are bound to come up for sale. Gus's being a case in point.
And
what will happen when he dies? Melanie won't have the first idea how to market his place.
I flicked another look at Henry, whose face was now carefully composed. In the 7 years I've known him, I've seen him lose his temper a handful of times, and his manner was always unfailingly mild. He didn't quite look at her.
What are you proposing?
I'm not proposing anything. I'm saying someone from out of state might misread the situation and underestimate the market value. If Gus or Melanie should raise the question, I'll give them your business card and you can rush right in.
Charlotte looked at him.
Excuse me? I didn't realize you were here to cultivate clients. Are you planning to farm the area? He asked.
He was referring to the real estate practice of working an area, sending flyers, calling on the residents, planting the seeds in hopes of harvesting a sale.
Of course not. We've already discussed the subject, and you made it clear you disapproved. If I offended you in some way, that wasn't my intent.
I'm sure it wasn't. But it does seem callous to be estimating home prices predicated on the deaths of people I've known for years.
Oh, for heaven's sake, Henry. You can't be serious. There's nothing personal in this. People die every day. I'm 78 myself, and I think estate planning is important.
Doubtless. You needn't take that tone. After all, there are tax implications. And what about the beneficiaries? For most people, a house is the largest asset they have, which is certainly true in my case. If I don't have a clue about property values, how can I determine a fair division among my heirs?
I'm sure you'll have it calculated down to the penny.
I wasn't speaking literally. I'm talking about the average person.
Gus isn't as average as you seem to think.
Where in heaven's name is all this hostility coming from?
You're the one who brought it up. Kinsey and I were discussing something else entirely.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt. It's clear you have your nose out of joint. But I haven't done anything except express an opinion. I don't understand what you're afraid of.
I don't want my neighbors to think I endorse solicitors.
Charlotte picked up her menu. I can see this is a point on which we can't agree, so why don't we leave it that way?
Henry picked up his menu as well and opened it. I'd appreciate that. And while we're about it, perhaps we could talk about something else.
I could feel my face flush. This was like marital bickering, except these two weren't that well acquainted. I thought Charlotte would be embarrassed by his tone, but she didn't bat an eye.
The moment passed. The rest of the dinner conversation was unremarkable, and the evening seemed to end on a pleasant note. Henry saw her to her car, and while the two said goodnight, I debated about mentioning the clash, but decided it wasn't my place. I knew what made him so touchy on the subject. At the age of 87, he had to be thinking about the financial aspects of his own demise. After Charlotte pulled away, we fell into step, walking the half block home.
I suppose you think I was out of line, he remarked.
Well, I don't think she's as mercenary as you implied. I know she's focused on her work, but she's not crass.
I was irritated.
Come on, Henry. She didn't mean any harm. She believes people should be informed about property values, and why not?
I suppose you're right.
It's not a question of who's right. The point is, if you're going to spend time together, you have to take her as she is. And if you don't intend to see her again, then why pick a fight?
Do you think I should apologize?
That's up to you, but it wouldn't do any harm. Late Monday afternoon, I scheduled an appointment with Lisa Ray to discuss her recollections about the accident for which she was being sued. The address she'd given me was a new condominium development in Colgate, a series of frame townhouses standing shoulder to shoulder in clusters of four. There were six exterior styles and four types of building materials: brick, frame, fieldstone, and stucco.
I was guessing 6 floor plans with mix-and-match elements that would make each apartment unique. The units were arranged in varied combinations, some with shutters, some with balconies, some with patios out front. Each foursome sat on a square of well-tended lawn. There were shrubs and flower beds and small, hopeful trees that wouldn't mature for another 40 years. In lieu of garages, the residents kept their vehicles in long carports that ran between the townhouses in horizontal rows. Most of the parking spaces were empty, which suggested people off at work. I saw no evidence of children. I found Lisa's house number and parked on the street out front. While I waited for her to answer the door, I sampled the air without detecting the scent of any cooking underway, probably too early. I imagined the neighbors would trickle home between 5:30 and 6. Dinner would be delivered in vehicles with signs on the top or pulled from the freezer in boxes complete with gaudy food photos. The oven and microwave instructions printed in type so small you'd have to don your reading glasses. Lisa Ray opened the door. Her hair was dark, cut short to accommodate its natural curl, which consisted of a halo of perfect ringlets. She was fresh-faced, with blue eyes and freckles, like tiny beige paint flecks across the bridge of her nose. She wore black flats, pantyhose, a red pleated skirt with a short-sleeved red cotton sweater.
Yikes! You're early. Are you Kinsey?
That's me. She opened the door and let me in, saying,
I didn't expect you to be so prompt. I just got home from work, and I'd love to get out of these clothes.
That's fine. Take your time.
I'll be back in a second. Have a seat.
I moved into the living room and settled on the couch while she took the stairs two at a time. I knew from the file that she was 26 years old, a part-time college student who paid her tuition and expenses by working 20 hours a week in the business office at St. Terry's Hospital. The apartment was small, white walls, beige wall-to-wall carpet that looked new and smelled of harsh chemicals. The furniture was a mix of garage sale finds and items she'd probably managed to cadge from home. 2 mismatched chairs, both upholstered in the same fake leopard print, flanked a red plaid couch with a coffee table filling the space between. A small wooden dinette table and 4 chairs were arranged at the far end of the room, with a pass-through to the kitchen off to the right. Checking the magazines on the coffee table, I had my choice of back issues of Glamour or Cosmopolitan. I picked Cosmopolitan, turning to an article about what men like in bed. What men? What bed? I hadn't had a close encounter with a guy since Cheney left my life. I was about to calculate the exact number of weeks, but the idea depressed me before I even started to count. 5 minutes later, Lisa reappeared, trotting down the stairs in jeans and a sweatshirt with the University of California Santa Teresa logo on the front. She took a seat in one of the upholstered chairs. I set the magazine aside. Is that where you went to school? I asked, indicating her shirt. She glanced down.
This is my roommate's. She's a secretary in the math department out there. I'm at City College part-time, working on an AA degree in radiography. St. Terry's has been great about my hours, pretty much letting me work when I want, she said.